Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The court has four causes which will be heard in three arguments for submission this morning. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Patty Lou Dawkins versus Fred Meyer and others, an original mandamus proceeding. Teresa Black versus the Dallas County Child Welfare Unit from Dallas County. And State of Texas and City of Austin versus Robert M. Schmidt and others from Travis County, and State of Texas and City of Austin versus Austech Limited and others from Travis County. The latter two causes will be combined for oral argument, and each side will be allotted 30 minutes to make their presentations. In the first two causes, each side has been allotted 20 minutes to make their presentations. We will take a brief recess in between each oral argument, but we'll complete the submission of these causes before our lunch break. The arguments are being recorded on tape for the convenience of the court. If anyone desires to listen to the tapes of this argument, you may make application to do so with the clerk of our court. The court is now ready to hear argument from relator in Dawkins versus Meyer.
May it please the court, Mr. Mazzola will present argument for relator. Relator has reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is John Mazzola. I practice law in Amarillo. Assisting me today is Harlow Sprouse, my partner, also Wolf Puckett, seated in the first row, next to whom is seated relator Patty Lou Dawkins. Relator is a candidate in the Republican primary for state representative, 87th District. She has been declared ineligible by respondent Fred Meyer in his capacity as state chairman of the Republican Party. The basis for that claim is Article 3, Section 19 of the Texas Constitution. Respondent claims that relator holds a lucrative office within the meaning of that provision. She is a board member of MHMR. The uncontroverted evidence in this case is that during her tenure, she has lost money from her service. The total amount of her expenses have exceeded her per diem compensation and the amount of expenses she has incurred.
Is that a decisive fact?
That is undisputed.
Is it decisive? That is to say, if it had not been the case, if she made money off this job, would it make a difference?
I don't think it would, Your Honor, because of the justum generis argument, which I'll address in a moment.
So your position is it doesn't make any difference whether she made money on $30 a day or lost money. You have another argument on which you rely.
Correct. To be within the constitutional prohibition, the respondent must cross two hurdles. Number one, he must prove that the office is lucrative within the common meaning of the term. And secondly, he must prove under the justum generis doctrine that the office is the same kind of lucrative office as those specifically listed in the provision. In addressing this issue, the court must be guided by the overriding rule of construction, which is constitutional provisions limiting the right to hold public office must be strictly construed against ineligibility. This is a principle that's established in all the election law cases. First, let's talk about justum generis. This provision is a classic example for the application of the doctrine. There are four specifically mentioned provisions which are subject to the prohibition, followed by a general catch-all. The rule of justum is, first, that this general language is not to be interpreted in its widest sense. Secondly, this language, the general language, is to be interpreted with reference to the class and kind of offices specifically enumerated.
Don't we have to overrule at least one and probably several decisions of this court?
You do not. In the very few reported cases on Article 3, Section 19. No litigant has claimed ejusdem generis applied. So that is a distinguishing feature.
You've read all the briefs.
Pardon me?
You've read all the briefs.
No, it certainly doesn't appear in the opinions that the claim was made.
Whether the claim was made or not, is Willis against Fox, should that fall by the wayside?
Well, Willis versus Potts is clearly distinguishable because there the evidence was that the candidate had profited from his office.
Well, I thought that was a question that you answered from Judge Heck long ago. Does it make any difference whether they, according to their bookkeeping, earn a living out of the job or it cost them?
Well, first of all, the definition of lucrative as defined in Willis versus Potts acknowledges that if you receive compensation, the office is not necessarily lucrative because it depends on net profits, whether you profited. The court pointed out in the definition that it quoted from the Kirk case that a low-paying office can be more lucrative if all the expenses are reimbursed. Now, the court has applied...
That's the question here. If this candidate's expenses were being fully reimbursed, not just to the extent of $75 a day, would this be a lucrative office?
It would be a lucrative office within the general meaning of the term, the commonly accepted definition. Then you could go to the ejusdem argument to reason that it is not the kind of lucrative office which is subject to the prohibition. It is not all lucrative offices that are subject to the prohibition when the doctrine is applied to the constitutional provision.
If all her expenses were paid in this case, fully reimbursed, and on top of that, she was paid a per diem, you would say that's a lucrative office, but still not one that is within the meaning of Article 3, Section 19.
Correct. Now, to demonstrate the principle, this court has applied the doctrine in a similar context in the Stanford case in 1944. In that case, the statute applied to the office of governor and all other state offices. The question was whether a presidential elector was within the statute. The court said, let's presume it's a state office. Is it the kind of state office like the office of governor? And the court applied the doctrine to hold, no, it was not, and therefore it was not within the ambit of the statute. We have also presented the court with the Capuzzi case, which is an Illinois Supreme Court case, interpreting a constitutional provision much like the one in question here. The court applied the doctrine and held that the offices under consideration there were not within the constitutional prohibition. And the reasoning of the court were that the specifically listed offices serve as the guide or standard for the kinds of offices included within the provision.
Now, if she made $10,000 a year, would that be within the meaning?
At some point, you reach the position where her office would be similar in lucrativeness to those specifically mentioned in the statute.
Where is that point?
I can't draw the line, but I know this is not the case where she's lost money, and her maximum has been a $30 a day per diem.
The consequence, then, of your argument is that you would have to decide in individual circumstances whether the office fell within the Constitution.
Well, some cases would clearly fall on either side. There would be some cases that would have to be decided on a case-by-case basis. This is not one of those close cases, however.
Well, and among those cases, as a further consequence of your argument, we're not just talking about members of the MHMR board, but we would be talking about perhaps every city council member in the state of Texas, wouldn't we?
The city council has been determined to be an office within the common definition of lucrative office.
So whatever we do, one way or the other, in this case, is going to have an impact on whether members of city councils can seek legislative office during the course of their term.
depending upon the specific statutes involved and how the candidates have been compensated.
Well, the issue that Judge Doggett just posed has already been decided against the eligibility of a city councilman in Willis versus Potts, hasn't it?
In a situation where it was clear that he received compensation plus reimbursement of all expenses.
But you say that makes no difference.
Well, it gets the it crosses the first hurdle of whether the common definition of lucrative office is met. Then you have to apply justum to determine if it's the same kind of lucrative office within the specifically enumerated classification.
Specifically, if your argument is correct, Willis was wrongly decided.
Because the justum was not presented to the court.
Counsel, you say the commonly used definition of lucrative. Black's dictionary lists several definitions. Would you please give us your definition of lucrative?
Well, in the Willis case, I think the court relied upon three different sources, and it quoted all of them with favor. And it said, based upon the above authorities, referring to all the authorities, that the relator's position in that case was lucrative. An important point, though, is that, and this is an excerpt from one of the definitions the court quoted with favor, and it stressed the concept of net profits. And this last sentence is very important. The expenses incident to an office with a high salary may render it less lucrative than other offices having a lower rate of compensation, which tells me that the fact that you receive $1 in compensation does not make an office lucrative. You have to go to the further question of whether the candidate profited from that office. And here it's uncontroverted.
Okay, but my question to you is, what definition are you asking us to adopt?
The net profits definition, which I think is substantiated by the court in Wilkes, and certainly in Whitehead, the same concept comes through.
Well, I'm still confused. Is it your argument that there are two elements to lucrative and both must be met, and because Ms. Dawkins in this case does not meet the profitability prong, that the Constitution doesn't apply for that reason and for additional reasons?
Well, there are two prongs. Relator meets both because she does not have a lucrative office because she has not profited, and she also, her office does not fit within the specific categories in Section 19.
Well, if she made $30 per diem and she managed to make a profit off of that, would that office fall within Article 3, Section 19 or not?
It would fall within the common definition, the first hurdle. It still would not fall within the justum argument because the other offices are different not only in terms of lucrative but in other ways that are determined.
If somebody was making $50,000 a year and still managed to lose money, would it fall within Article 3, Section 19 or not?
It probably would because depending on the other classifications of the argument office, it would be similar to those offices specifically mentioned in the statute. And let me discuss the specifically mentioned offices.
Similar because of the amount of money they're paid?
Well, I'll address that. First of all, the Capuzzi Court made several comparisons which are of a guide in how you compare offices for purpose of the justum argument. Here, these are the relevant differences. The listed offices are full-time. Relator holds a part-time office by statute. The board only meets four times a year. The listed offices are all offices that are exercised by individuals. The individuals are clothed with governmental power. By contrast, relator is one of nine members. The responsibilities of the board of MHMR are to represent the public to the department. Relator is prohibited by board policy from participating in the administration of the agency. It is clear to the extent that she has governmental power, it is much more diluted than that of the individuals whose offices are specifically listed.
Counsel, have you examined the debates of the constitutional framers, looked any of the discussion during ratification to try to fathom what the policy behind Article 3, Section 19 is?
They're,
is lucrative really the key, or is it a separation of powers?
I could find very little on that. All I could find was that there are some commentators, and this is subject to debate, who say this relates back to a 1700 Act of Parliament. And so it's very hard to discern what the constitutional purpose is beyond the language of the provision itself. Finally, comparing the listed offices to that of relator's position, very important in the terms of salary. Now, this gets into the question of how lucrative is the office. Is it as lucrative as the specifically mentioned office is? And
Counselor, your time has expired, and I think you can read the chart. Does anyone else have any questions?
Just one, Counsel, and it's really more in the nature of an observation to you and opposing counsel. My wife is executive director of the Association for Retarded Citizens, appears not infrequently in front of the MHMR board, including Ms. Dawkins. That doesn't bother or affect me, but I want to disclose it, and if either of you have any concern about my sitting in the case, please make it known to the court immediately. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Daniels will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, V.D. Daniel for Fred Meyer, chairman of the State Republican Party. I believe the error that has led us into this thicket of trying to determine eligibility on the basis of matching up full-time individual salaried versus part-time, not individual, per diem, comes from a misapplication of what I would call the justem generis doctrine. Like any other statutory construction doctrine, this particular old principle is designed to assist the court in determining the meaning of words in either constitutional or statutory provision. It is not a separate hurdle to be leaped, to be hurdled, in order to determine eligibility. It is merely a doctrine of statutory construction to assist the court in determining the meaning of the words in the constitutional provision. In this case, we don't need the help of this particular doctrine or any other particular doctrine in determining the meaning of the word lucrative in Article 3, Section 19. Each of the cases cited in Willis v. Potts, this court's decision in Whitehead, Black's Law Dictionary, all contain accepted meanings of the word lucrative. In the Wyoming case cited in Willis v. Potts, the Wyoming Supreme Court cites an old treatise on public officers. And his first sentence says, Mr. Meacham's first sentence says, an office to which salary, compensation, or fees are attached is a lucrative office. The Indiana case.
If instead of having $75 per meeting or whatever it came out to and $30 additional, up to $75 of got reimbursed expenses and 30 additional, there'd been $105 up to that for actual expenses. Would this be a different case?
I apologize, Your Honor. I did not.
If you had the same total amount being given to the members, but it all had to be justified by documentation as actual expenditures, so that there was no possibility of any, no theoretical possibility of any actual profit, is that a different case?
That's Whitehead, Your Honor.
The vice comes just down in the structure of the way the
That's correct. Each of those definitions I was going to cite to you said that a lucrative office ties to a salary for services performed. So if the legislature or, in the case of Willis, the city charter says we are going to give these particular office holders a fixed sum of money for showing up and serving in this office, that makes that office lucrative. It was $10 in Willis. And it That's an easy test, and that's what lucrative means. That's what all of these cases agree that lucrative means. So we really don't need to step to any other statutory construction doctrine to answer the questions. If you step out of that very straightforward, is it a salary or is it not a salary, and attempt to apply any other test, I submit that you get way off track in terms of determining who is going to be eligible and who's not going to be eligible, and you get into some fairly tough arguments about who's eligible and who's not eligible.
So in this case, this $70 to $5 a day for meals and lodging, as well as a compensatory per diem of $30 a day, are those set by board regulation?
No, Your Honor. They are set, the statute for MHMR
sets that.
Does not set it. It specifically, it sets it by reference to the General Appropriations Act. And then Article 6813F, which they also cite, can override any other provisions, but it overrides those provisions to require that the General Appropriations Act apply. Okay. So the two statutes are consistent. And so it is the General Appropriations Act decision to have a $30 per diem and to limit expenses to $75 per day that is applicable.
So that applies not only to MHMR, but to a wide range of state-appointed boards and commissions?
That's correct, Your Honor. It is the fact that the MHMR statute provides for the per diem compensation, the fixed salary, in addition to reimbursement of expenses, that makes the office lucrative.
Have any idea how many state board and commission members are made ineligible under your interpretation by the statutory scheme you described?
Your Honor, I have no idea. I would presume that it is a substantial number of board members, just as the Willis v. Potts case makes ineligible a substantial number of city council persons. And if I can use that to go back to the Houston Gennaris argument, and it doesn't get us very far. Okay,
now,
certainly.
Then, under your interpretation, all of these people could be made eligible by a statutory change, but a statutory change would be required in the Appropriations Act.
That's correct, Your Honor. The example we cite in the brief is, and I think maybe I can bring it even closer to home, certainly I can bring it closer to home. Many of those board members live here in Austin. I would be stunned to find out that those board members incurred more than $75 per day, more than $105 per day in expenses in serving their board memberships. Under the theory advanced by Ms. Dawkins, all of those people, all those board members who live here in Austin and don't exceed $105 per day, they're still ineligible under the lucrative test because they have profited, whereas people who spend more than $105 per day would become eligible.
Can they also remove their disability by resigning?
Oh, certainly.
At any time?
Well, they're appointed for fixed terms.
But if they tender, Ms. Dawkins, for example, tendered her resignation today, or at the time, let me put it back at the time that her application was filed, would she then be eligible?
Presuming that the tender of resignation was effective, which I think it would be, yes, Your Honor, because we are only talking about, in her case, we're only talking about an overlap of terms of the month of January of 1993. That's correct.
By the same token, to follow up on Justice Doggett's question, a city could make its council members eligible to run for legislature simply by changing the ordinance to provide for full reimbursement of expenses rather than per diem compensation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Then you would not have Willis versus Potts as an obstacle.
That's correct, Your Honor. I agree with the import of the question. You have to overrule Willis v. Potts in order to make Ms. Dawkins eligible. I don't think there's any question about that. Follow up, Judge Dockett, my mother-in-law is a city council person in Houston. She happens to be full-time. She gets a salary, a substantial salary, because that's how the Houston City Charter is constructed. She, however, does not exercise individual authority. She has to act as part of the City Council of Houston. So where does she fit in this line? Whereas there are other City Council members, of course, who are part-time, and they may get more than $30 per day in salary. They may get less. They may get $10. That's Willis. The simple answer is lucrative means what all these cases say it means. It's a fixed salary. And if the legislature wants to make all of these people eligible, they can remove the salary. If the City Council want to make all their City Council members eligible, they can remove any salary portion.
Mr. Daniel, do you have a theory as to the purpose of Article 3, Section 19?
It is all part of the various constitutional provisions that are designed to ensure the separation of powers. In this case, we have mentioned both judges and executive officials as the specific examples, the Attorney General, the Secretary of State, the clerk of any court of record, and the judge of any court of record. So we have both the judicial branch and the executive branch mentioned. And basically it says those people in these two branches of government cannot serve in the legislative branch at the same time, and it maintains the separateness of the powers in that respect. That's Willis v. Potts, Your Honor. That's correct. That's
$1 a year.
Unfortunately, if it is denominated as compensation for showing up and serving in that office, it makes that office a lucrative office. The cases that Willis v. Potts refers to, cited with favor, for example, in the Wyoming case, they emphasized the sentence in the treatise, the amount of the salary or compensation attached is not material. Acknowledging that, at least at the time the Constitution was passed, that the Secretary of State in serving that office, which is specifically mentioned, might very well lose money because of the expense of serving in that office, but that the word lucrative farther down in Section 19 does refer to compensation, fixed compensation, for actually serving in the office. And that's what all of the cases agree to, and that's the distinction between Whitehead and Willis. And in the Willis case, it was a $10 per diem for the City Council member to show up to serve on the Fort Worth City Council that made Mr. Willis ineligible to run for the legislature.
Counsel, can you enlighten us a little bit about the timing in this case? In other words, what happens on certain days and how expeditious would the court need to be?
I believe that Ms. Dawkins has identified one of the key days that we need to focus on. Ms. Dawkins is going to be on the ballot. The decision to disqualify Ms. Dawkins came long after the 62nd or 65th day before the primary election, which is the last day she could have been kept off the ballot. So her name will appear on the primary ballot. First voting, I believe, begins February 19th. So in order to inform the voters in this particular district,
Your Honor. It's already started, hasn't it? Haven't the county clerks received requests for absentee ballots from people outside the county or the state or the United States to which they have mailed absentee ballots already?
That could very well be true, Your Honor. The actual in-person absentee voting does not begin until February 19th.
I'm talking about in-person. Talking about.
You're exactly correct, Your Honor. So to some degree, we're beyond some days, but for the vast majority of the people who are going to vote for this particular district office, it would be helpful for them to know, those persons who are going to actually go physically in the county and vote, it would be helpful for them to know by February 19th whether or not Ms. Dawkins is, in fact, eligible for the office. And I believe that, in other words, you're cutting, as Justice Mossie indicates, if any delay beyond that date, you're just cutting into more the voting decisions of even more people in the district.
Back to the purpose question. Assuming that the person could not hold some other office, such as an agency appointment or a city council position, and a legislative office at the same time, it doesn't seem that separation of powers is helped much by a provision that says you can't run for the office while you're holding an agency or some other sort of position.
Your Honor, I'm not arguing that it's a perfect application of the separation of powers doctrine, and certainly there are other constitutional provisions that when you weave them together, the separation of powers that the Constitution writers decided, or they decided on, this is important to separate, this is not important to separate, they drew particular lines. I'm not here to tell you that they're perfect lines, but in order to make a workable system of law, you have to draw lines in a particular place, and as we've said, the lucrative line has to be drawn. Ms. Dawkins just clearly lies on the other side of it.
Let's explore what happens depending on what we do here. Ms. Dawkins' name is already on the ballot, and if she wins the primary, and if this court agrees with your position, she is ineligible to serve, then what happens?
Your Honor, it's laid out specifically by statute in the election code. I don't have those specific provisions.
Well, does it go to the district committee, which is made up of the county chairman of the party in each of the districts that comprise the legislative district, to pick the nominee then?
I believe that would be the consequence of her receiving the majority vote in the primary election. I would have to check the election code specifically on that, because the first step is you do count her votes, and then I guess since there are only two candidates in this particular primary election, then I'm fairly certain the election code provides that if she were to get the majority vote, then that would create a vacancy that the executive committee would fill.
Would they be powerless to appoint her under your interpretation of the law?
Yes, because she's ineligible for that particular session of the legislature because of the overlap in her particular board membership in MHMR.
Even if she should resign?
I believe that changes the answer as I answered it, Justice Cornyn, before. I believe that's...
Do you have cases on that? Because it's certainly not clear.
On the resignation point?
It's not clear.
I am not professing that I know the answer to that. I don't know that a tender of her resignation would necessarily be effective. I thought that's how I qualified my answer. I apologize. If her tender of resignation is effective, I would think that she's not the holder of a lucrative office that overlaps with the next session of the legislature, so that if her tender of resignation were effective, I would think that should cure her. By the words of the constitutional provision, that should cure her ineligibility.
That's under the word holding a lucrative office. So if you don't hold it.
That's correct. She would not.
That could be interpreted the other way. That's an open question.
I'm not aware of any cases that resolve that particular issue. Like I say, it seems that the statute would say that if she doesn't hold it, since the overlap that causes her ineligibility is next January, the month of January 1993, if she does not hold that office during January of 1993, then she would become eligible. But that's why I'm saying I'm not sure that with a fixed term of office, like MHMR, I don't know whether her tender of resignation would be effective.
Would the time be whether she holds it at the time of the beginning of the legislature, or as Section 19 says, being elected? Would the resignation have come before the election day?
I apologize, Your Honor. I do not have the answer. to that question. I think it's an open issue whether a tender of resignation of an office for a fixed term is going to be effective within the last year of that term.
How many counties are in this legislature?
There are two, Your Honor. I believe it's Potter and Randall. Potter and Moore, I apologize, Your Honor.
Is this a new district where the line's been redrawn?
I didn't know there were any districts whose lines had not been redrawn.
Is there an incumbent in this race?
Ms. Dawkins' opponent in the Republican primary is the incumbent, and then there are two candidates, Democratic candidates in the Democratic primary. I will yield the rest of my time if there are no further questions.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I'm sorry.
Mr. Sprague will present rebuttal for
The case of Lee versus Daniels by this court, which we think was wrong, held that Mrs. Dawkins cannot become eligible by resigning before the end of her term. Her term overlaps by 21 days, the term of the legislature. She'd be probably happy to do that, but that's not one of her alternatives. Just to quickly sum up the rules as stated by this court in the past. A constitutional provision should be strictly construed against ineligibility. Now, the facts are not in dispute, just as the facts were not in dispute in either Willis or Whitehead. In Willis, the facts were undisputed that there was some profit. In Whitehead, the facts were undisputed that there was no profit. That is, the expenses exceeded the remuneration. On the record, then, in this case, uncontradicted record, relator meets the test of Whitehead and does not become ineligible under Willis. And as this court said in Whitehead, that uncontradicted affidavit is binding. It can't be lucrative under the definitions of this court in Willis, quoted from other cases in Willis, if you lost money. The respondent says there are two forms of remuneration. We think not. There's only one form. It's called money. And you either have an excess of it or a deficit. And this relator has a deficit. Her expenses exceeded the remuneration.
Isn't there a factual issue that this court is powerless to determine the mandamus?
Well, as I understand the record before you, there is an uncontroverted affidavit that her reasonable expenses exceeded the remuneration, whatever you call the remuneration. I'm not sure I understand the question, Judge Phillips.
Well, perhaps in this case, an affidavit's not controverted. We could consider that under your theory, but in many cases, under your standard, this would not be an issue that appellate courts could readily determine by.
Yes, I agree with that. Yes, but in this case it's easy, and in Whitehead it was easy, and they said there was a loss, and it can't be lucrative if there's a loss.
Does that mean that that Mr. Slagle for the Democratic Party or Mr. Meyer for the Republican Party would need to hold some sort of hearing or make some sort of factual determination that that the expenses incurred by an appointee exceeded their per diem allowance and their actual expenses?
I assume so, if that were the only gauge. Of course, we don't believe that if it were lucrative by $30 a year or $50 a year, it's the kind of lucrative office that should make you ineligible.
You've got two theories.
Yes,
let's just stick with
but yes, I agree that there would have to be somebody that has to draw the line.
Who else would have the standing? Let's suppose that Mr. Meyer does not challenge this affidavit, as he's not to date in this court. Perhaps Mr. Meyer doesn't really care. It's just a stakeholder, essentially. Does Dawkins' primary opponent have the right to intervene and challenge that affidavit? Do the candidates in the other primary have the right? Do interested citizens have the right?
I would think so.
Mr. Frowes, if the office held, as opposed to the office run for, if the office held is like one of the offices in Article 3, Section 19, it doesn't matter whether the holder made a profit or not, right?
No, I disagree with that.
Well, it does make
it difference. It does have to be a lucrative office, because and that's the definition of lucrative office.
So if the salary...
But even if it is a lucrative office, it isn't necessarily a patent.
So if the salary is $50,000 a year, but you still manage to lose money, it would not be a lucrative office?
If it's through reasonable expenses, which the affidavit in this case shows. And as a matter of fact, this court quoted a case from Indiana that talked in terms of a high salary could be less lucrative because of large expenses. And it seems to me that if the expenses can make it less lucrative, they can make it non-lucrative.
So under your theory, if I spend more money each month than I make, my job is not lucrative.
If there are expenses incident to your office, Judge, I think that's true, but it can't be true on the rest of it, or half the legislators couldn't run for office, because most of us spend more than we make. But.
Counsel, are you saying that the nature of the office, other than those enumerated in the constitutional provision, is irrelevant? It's how much the individual is required to expend in the performance of the job? In other words,
no.
Under the provision in the Constitution, I would assume that an auxiliary municipal judge who served voluntarily for a fixed term would probably be ineligible.
I believe so.
Just as ineligible as a justice on this court.
No, excuse me. I do not believe that because of the doctrine of a justum generis. But on the question of whether it's lucrative or not,
constitutional provisions specifically articulate that judges, period.
Yes.
It doesn't say, doesn't relate to
federal judge,
municipal judge, auxiliary part-time municipal judge.
Judges are expressly excluded.
Even if they serve free of charge.
I agree.
They are prohibited.
Yes.
But other than those offices enumerated, you're saying it depends entirely upon whether the individual involved expends more than they make out of the job, that they get a fixed $75 a day for expenses, and they spend $150 a day reasonably, which could easily be done for your hotel room alone.
Yes.
To perform the function, then they are eligible to run. But if they live here locally and they get this fixed $75 a day or the $30 a day and don't claim any of the $75, then they are ineligible to run because they've made some money.
I think Willis and Whitehead stand for that proposition.
Wouldn't that just have some awful inconsistent results across the board?
I believe it would, but of course Willis and Whitehead are inconsistent and awful because of that very thing. They both dealt with less money than most of us spend on coffee or soft drinks, yet one of them was held ineligible.
What's the underlying purpose in this constitutional provision? I've heard it was argued back, related back to the 1701 Act of Parliament, to prevent the monarchy from intruding on the House of Commons. Here we're concerned about the judiciary and executive infringing on the influence of the third house, the House and Senate, the third branch of government, the legislative branch. I would assume.
I don't believe the purpose was to
whether this infringes on that, isn't it?
I don't believe the purpose was to make ineligible citizens who are serving in state government at a loss. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.
Thank you.